Chapter 15, Taiwan. The guys in the Taipei gym had arranged a hotel room for me for the first night in exchange for teaching a few classes. I would gladly help a little bit, and a nice private hotel room felt like the perfect exchange. It was clean, modern, and had a very comfortable bed. I still had no idea what would happen the next day or how I would get to the gym. I had Wi-Fi in my room and checked a few emails before I went to bed. Daniel, a Scottish guy, was training in Taiwan for 3 months and suggested we could meet up and train, or maybe he could give me a lift to the city down south I had planned to visit. I looked him up on Facebook. Dantastic was his name. At that point, I already knew that a road trip with that guy would be a cool one, so I wrote him right away. Savage, he replied, and promised to come pick me up the next day. I had dark circles under my eyes when I was standing outside of the hotel room in the morning, waiting for Daniel. He had some problems with the Chinese road names, but finally he pulled up to the front of the hotel in a small yellow car. Daniel was a tall, long-limbed guy with brown hair, a short beard, and a Scottish accent that was hard to understand. From the first handshake, we had an instant connection. He had been trying to make the Taiwanese people understand his humor for months without luck, so when someone finally laughed at his jokes, it was like he couldn't stop them coming. I had missed having someone to act silly with, and the chemistry was there right away. Signs were in Chinese everywhere on the busy roads, and I really felt like I had come to a very different place compared to where I had been so far. We had no idea what to do, but since the only thing I knew about Taiwan was that it had one of the tallest buildings in the world, we decided to go check it out. On the bottom floor, we tried to find some food in the food court. Everything looked really strange. "You handsome, you very handsome," a woman in her 60s working at a little noodle shop told us, which somehow convinced us to pick her food. At the top of the tower, they served a stunning view and draft beer with vanilla ice cream. I wanted to concentrate on being amazed about how far up in the sky we were, but the ice cream beer took most of my attention. For most of my life, I have been fascinated by skyscrapers and have made it my project to be able to say I had taken a dump on the top floor of each and every one of them. The Empire State Building, CN Tower, Rockefeller Center, and the Eiffel Tower had already been conquered by my ass, and now I could proudly add the Taipei 101 to the list. In the evening, we went to the gym. A few guys from there had emailed me and invited me to come train with them. The sign on the second floor of the building was difficult to see from the sidewalk, and we knocked on a few doors before we found the right one. Coming up the stairs, I was met by the distinct, internationally standardized smell of sweaty geese. We had come to the right place. I said hi to a few guys who were sitting on the mats, talking and stretching. I had heard a lot of good things about the head instructor of the gym, a Japanese guy named Makoto. Unfortunately, he was not in the country that week, as he had gone to Japan to do a seminar. He had left a message for me on the whiteboard hanging on the wall. "Welcome to Taiwan BJJ! BJJ Globetrotter Mr. Christian!" He seemed excited. One of the guys gave me an envelope from him with a letter and a set of keys. "Dear Mr. Christian, I am in Japan for a seminar. Very sorry cannot be there to meet you. Please take keys to the gym if you need a place to sleep or train. Thank you, Makoto." I was bummed that I didn't get to meet that guy. I already liked him. After me and Jaguar's few rolls on the beach canvas, I was looking forward to training in a real indoor gym again. It looked like there would be plenty of folks to spar with there. A few purple, lots of blue belts, and the mandatory Swedish guy were on the map. Swedes are everywhere in the world. Many people from my trip had told me about how good this particular gym was, and I couldn't help feeling a bit uncertain about my own level. I still wasn't completely comfortable about rolling with strangers who could potentially make me feel like I was nowhere near brown belt level. I'm not at all the type of guy that ever worried about belt colors or ego, but suddenly being an internet BJJ celebrity made my mind play tricks on me, and I didn't like it. I told myself to forget it. I shouldn't be afraid to wrestle with other adults because of some imaginary hierarchy. Why should it stop me from just having fun with it? It really doesn't make sense to try and sharply divide the skill level of individual athletes into so many categories anyways. Imagine a ranking system like that in any other sport, like maybe tennis, golf, or basketball. Measuring your expectations of performance against whoever you clap hands with through these nonsense visual indicators is impossible. Despite being a cute idea, belts symbolize many other things than just how you're supposed to do in sparring and competition. We are each on our own journey. I knew this, but it took some work to ignore the negative thoughts my brain created. I taught a class on the guard passing concepts I had been working on. It was an extremely narrow room and people kept bumping into each other. Only around 20 people were on the mats, but it felt extremely crowded. My fears about performing were, of course, only in my head. I did well, and so what if anyone tapped me out? It was the fight or flight syndrome. My brain was trying to convince me to run away from the dangerous situation, but as soon as I jumped into it, there was no fear at all. It was all enjoyable to roll with the very cool and skilled guys. We went an hour of solid sparring. Daniel had a great game. He was athletic, flexible, and had a strong grip. Because the room was so small, people took turns standing around the couples rolling and holding puzzle mats up so they didn't hit each other. It was like rolling inside a private moving cabin with guys standing around it. It was kind of weird in a cool sort of way, but still didn't top the ice cream beer. Daniel was staying with Irene, a Taiwanese girl he met in Texas who had invited him over to visit for a few months. She offered me to stay in her guest room, and since we were leaving for our little road trip the next day, I thought that was better than to sleep in the gym. The place was designed for people whose average heights were much lower than mine or Daniel's. I got to train my standing guard passing posture in the shower as I had to hip forward and lean heavily back in order to get my head under the water. Then I checked out my chest in the mirror while drying my hair. We ended up in an all-you-can-drink bar with the guys from the gym. The floor was sticky, gripping our shoes, making sure we didn't fall off the face of the earth. It was difficult to get to the bar, so when we finally made it through the line, we needed to order a lot. Daniel asked for 2 triple rum and cokes and 2 of the same shots the guys before us had just had. Double size. They looked like some kind of glowing candy shots. We said cheers to a good trip the next day and downed the shots. Immediately, my throat closed and my eyes opened up wide. It was double absinthe shots. It took me a few seconds to recover my thoughts and resurface from getting kicked in the face by my own stupidity. Daniel suddenly looked really pale. The smile he had been wearing since I met him the same morning had drastically faded. Then came one of the strangest moments of my life when he looked me straight into the eyes and, without moving, bending over, or making any sound, he opened his mouth a little bit and slowly threw up into a glass he was holding in his hand. It had a muddy gray color and was flowing in a steady white stream down in the glass and out onto his hand. His face was like stone, not revealing to anyone around him in the crowded bar what was going on. He was still looking me in the eyes and hadn't even blinked yet as he realized that he couldn't stand there with a glass full of gray vomit and do nothing about it. In a nonchalant move, cold as a Siberian assassin, he turned the glass upside down, spilling the contents out on his own shoes. Then he swiftly grabbed the newly ordered triple rum and coke and poured it into the sticky and smelly glass in his hand. Like a boss. I was speechless and decided it was maybe time for us to leave. We just needed to get some food on the way. The guy from the gym explained to us that there were no fast food places, but we could go to a regular restaurant that was open all night. We had duck breast and steamed rice in a fine restaurant, dirty drunk at 5 a.m. I like to eat when I'm drunk. Once, in my young, irresponsible teens, we crashed a family party of one of our classmates. They had finished the dinner hours before, and I found a whole roast ham in the kitchen. I cleverly snuck it out and hid it in a gutter by the roof outside, thinking that I would get hungry later and could eat it on the way home from the party. My secret little hiding place was, to my big surprise, pretty dirty, and I broke my tooth on a little rock when I greedily tried to eat the ham while waiting for the night bus home. Karma lesson for me. With a dose of heavy hangovers, I threw my backpack in the back of the little yellow car in the morning. Daniel only packed a toothbrush and a pair of shorts for training. "What the fuck are we doing here?" I said to Daniel as we found ourselves in the middle of an empty boulevard surrounded by tall, dark buildings way past midnight. We had promised to drop off a microwave oven on the west coast of the island, which ended up sending us on a massive detour, and we had to find a place to stay for the night. Only a few people were out on the streets. Young kids were sitting around on the street corners looking at us like we were aliens from another planet. It felt like we were just that, so I couldn't really blame them. We found a hotel for the night. The lobby was all covered in marble, and there was at least 10 meters to the ceiling. We got a room on the 20th floor, and it wasn't too expensive. Daniel had spotted a nightclub from the window and suggested we go there and check it out. I only had sandals, so the chances of them letting us in were slim, but there was nothing left to do in the official middle of Asian nowhere. We tried to look as casual as we possibly could as we crossed the street. I concentrated hard on trying to look like someone who was wearing shoes. The bouncers had spotted us a mile away, and we hadn't even gotten to the door before one of them said something really mad in Chinese and pointed at my dirty old sandals. They didn't understand a word of English, but we still tried to convince them to let us in. Eventually, they got too annoyed with us, and we decided it was time to give up. We went for a walk down the empty streets to see what was going on in our newly found mystery town. Around the corner was something equivalent to a dollar store. It sold all kinds of strange stuff, and everything had the same price. Daniel told me he once succeeded in getting into a nightclub by pulling black socks over a pair of sandals so it looked like shoes in the dark. There was no way we were not going to give that a shot. I put on Daniel's shoes, assuming that they would be looking at my feet if we came back. And after about 15 minutes of non-stop laughing on the sidewalk, we finally got 3 pairs of socks pulled over my sandals on Daniel's feet. It looked absolutely ridiculous, but in the dark of night, it was surprisingly difficult to tell. The biggest problem would be to not laugh when we got back there. We failed. The bouncers had almost let us in, but then as one of them bent down and lit up Daniel's feet with his flashlight, we broke out laughing and gave up. The bouncers didn't find it nearly as funny as we did, but despite the language barrier, I could tell they were impressed with our effort. We ended up hanging out in a small bar, the only one we could find. We spent a whole night hanging out with the owner, a very gay guy who thought we were professional wrestlers from the WWF and whose daughter worked as a waitress dressed up as a nurse, drinking his 100-year-old Japanese whiskey and betting on whether or not he would sing along to the chorus of John Bon Jovi songs. It was a strange night out. We drove for hours and hours the next day through small villages and along vast stretches of beautiful coastal road with black sand beaches and green mountains before finally making it to our destination in the late afternoon. A text message from Val beeped in on my phone. He was waiting for us by the entrance to the university. About half an hour of trying to enter the address of the place using Chinese characters on the GPS and a detour going literally through a rice field, we found Val waiting for us by the gate to a gigantic campus area. It was the weekend and the place was totally deserted. One big gray concrete building after the other was spread over a vast area surrounded by nothing but fields and dirt roads. In the humid mist, it looked like something out of a post-apocalyptic Hollywood movie. I had no idea what to expect there. Val has said there would be some training and I asked if I could teach a class. As he walked up the wide stairs of the empty building, he showed us the door to the training room. I expected it to be a small place like many of the other places I'd been to. I couldn't believe my eyes. From driving hours and hours into the Taiwanese countryside, a place like this was the last thing I thought I would find. It was by far the biggest mat I had ever seen in my life. It was a professional-style judo gym with something near 1,000 square meters of tatami mats, at least 15 meters to the ceiling, weightlifting equipment, climbing ropes, and big wall-to-wall windows in each end of the room. The first thing that came to mind was that it reminded me of an airplane hangar. At least 200 or more people could easily train on the mat at the same time and have plenty of room to throw each other around. Daniel had just broken the world record for saying savage most times in a day as we both stood there and looked at it with our mouths open in awe. More people started to show up and we ended with a solid little group of about 20 people. I did a class on sweeps and then attached my iPad to the stereo and played loud 70s rock and roll music for a good hour of sparring. There were a handful of judo girls there. They were smaller than the kids on my kids' team, but obviously training at a really high level. After training, I lifted some weights for a bit. I really missed the physical training that I had no time or energy for on the trip. There was no chance I was going to win that season's Gun Festival, a highly prestigious annual summer competition in my gym where everyone measures their arms, pumps the gun for 2 months, and then find out who grew the most and should receive the honor of being that year's champion. Val introduced us to Gray, an American guy from Arkansas, whose house in the mountains we would be staying at. He was tall and lanky, moved around in a very relaxed way, and used the word bro a lot. "What's up, bro?" he said. After an interesting dinner at an outdoors aboriginal restaurant consisting of snails and other strange stuff the locals had found in the jungle, we drove up a steep mountain road to Gray's place. He had married a Taiwanese girl and was teaching English in a local school. His house was built in concrete by a simple design and located next to a big stream surrounded by the dense forest. A few chickens were sleeping behind a fence. His two little dogs were very interested in the guest and he had a classic old motorbike parked in the driveway. A tin roof covered an outdoor area from the rain. Under it stood a couch, a few plastic chairs, and a wooden table. Bananas and passion fruits were hanging in the trees all around us. I went to sleep in the guest room. Daniel and Gray were drinking beers outside, but I was too tired to do anything but sleep. It was a bedroom with a small bathroom, solidly built in concrete. As I brushed my teeth, I observed myself in the mirror. I looked very different from when I had left home. My hair was getting longer and curlier. My skin was darker, and I hadn't shaved for a while. I felt different too. Something inside of me was changing. Lying in the bed, it started raining heavily. The sound from the drops hitting the tin roof were loud. I put in my earplugs and tucked myself in under the small blanket. I felt a bit lonely and sent an expensive text message to my girlfriend. She didn't feel far away when I was online, but in the Taiwanese mountains, my only option was a text message now and then, and I couldn't afford to send many of them. I hadn't talked to her in almost 2 weeks, and I hoped I would be able to find an internet connection somewhere that was fast enough to call her from. She texted me back, and the little 160-character-long connection to home made me feel good again. I was looking forward to see her when I finally made it to New York, even though it felt like it was still ages away. The rain had picked up. I hoped it would pass before the next day so we could go surfing. The chickens outside the window woke me up in the morning. They sounded exactly like Angry Birds, a game I was playing on my phone, and I couldn't help laughing a little bit. I was sharing the double bed with Daniel, who had been up late, drinking beers with Gray. He wasn't really sharing, since he was lying diagonally from one corner of it to the other. I realized that I'd been curled up like a ball, cramped up against the wall in a corner of the bed all night. He was out cold, impossible to wake up, and I almost had to butterfly sweep him in order to move him to his own side of the bed. Gray had already packed the surfboards on the car and was ready to go. Daniel worked hard on the project of opening his eyes, as Gray told us we needed to get going before he had to work. The crazy Scotsman and I took our little yellow sports car and drove behind Gray down the mountain. He had warned us that the dogs might try to follow us when they figured out we were going to the beach. Going down, we noticed the dog standing out on the road, looking at us leave. As we got around the first corner, it had started chasing us. Gray in front of us was already driving at reckless speed, and Daniel accelerated the yellow lightning, trying to catch up with him. I shouted in panic for Daniel to floor it as I looked through the back window and saw the little dog literally fly down the hill to catch us. I have never in my life seen a dog run so fast. It only touched the ground every 10 meters or so. The rest of the time, it was hovering over the road, speeding after us like a bullet. Despite driving as fast as we possibly could, the dog finally caught up with us as we got down to the bottom of the mountain. Gray got out of his car and let the dog in on the back seat, not wanting it to keep chasing us on the highway amongst the other cars. It was so tired, it looked like it was about to cough up its lungs from exhaustion. As we drove along the mountains down to the coast, Gray stopped at the side of the road to tighten the straps holding the surfboards a little bit more. The front door of his car was open, and Jack Johnson was playing from his stereo. It was an old white Ford Fiesta, and by white I mean brown. It was dirty, falling apart, and in general not very well kept. It didn't seem to be important though. Gray lived the life he wanted, the life many people in the world dream about but never have the guts to go for. A quiet, simple home, out in nature with good friends, surfing, jiu-jitsu, a meaningful job, a beautiful wife, and soon their first child. He had broken out of the norms and expectations of modern Western society and followed his intuition. It had taken him all the way to the mountains of Taiwan in an old dirty car with his wife in the front seat, a dog hanging out the window, and three surfboards strapped on the roof. That vehicle, that day, seemed to contain everything he needed to live a happy life. It was difficult not to admire as I observed him standing next to it, leaning over the roof, reaching for the surfboard straps. The beach was wide and deserted. The sand was black, and green bushes and trees had hidden it from the road. "We gotta paddle all the way around that break to get to the outside, bros," Gray said, and pointed out into the water, explaining about the directions of the currents. The clouds above our heads were heavy, and it was eerily dark for that time of the day. The water looked wild and scary. I had only been surfing in shallow water in Bali so far, and paddling out into the dark big sea frightened me. I had to do it. The water felt cold on my legs as we walked out. Daniel and I had big beginner's foam boards that floated easily, which calmed me a bit. I got onto mine and started to paddle towards the waves. The first one was big and crashed right on top of me. I could see my board go flying through the air, milliseconds before I tumbled under the water and rolled around on the sand bottom. When I finally got up past the break, it was quiet. The three of us were sitting on our boards and waiting. The water was still and there was no wind. The scenery was stunning. In front of us was the wide, empty volcanic beach, and behind it, majestic green mountain walls stood straight up for hundreds and hundreds of meters right in front of us. The water was perfectly clean and looked black from the volcanic sand. I could see my feet clearly, but beneath them it was pitch dark. The contrast looked strange, almost like a black background of a studio photograph. It started to rain a slight drizzle. The drops landed calmly on the water around us. Right there, I felt a connection, a meditative feeling of being at one with nature. For a moment, I forgot my fear of the ocean and was totally comfortable just sitting there, far away from land, relaxing. The silence was suddenly broken by Gray shouting like a maniac. "Here it comes, bro. Paddle like a motherfucker, bro." Daniel and I turned around and started paddling. My shoulders were burning from doing military presses in the judo gym the night before, but I gave it all I had. The wave was too big for us, and we were thrown around in nature's big washing machine. The current was strong, and we had to constantly paddle to stay in the right place. Eventually, my sore shoulders had had enough, and it was far between the waves, so I decided to paddle in and rest a bit. Halfway in, I sat on the board and took a break while looking at the guys. They were far out from where I was sitting and waiting for the waves to come. Suddenly, a wall of water started to lift up behind me. It was dark but crystal clear, and I could almost see right through it. I held my breath for a second before I came to my senses, and I realized that this was my chance. I quickly turned the board around and started paddling. The adrenaline pumped through my entire body, and the mountains in front of me disappeared in my tunnel vision. The wave crashed behind me with a large roaring sound before hitting me with a vicious force that pushed me forward like a horse had just kicked me in the ass. The speed was intense, and I could feel the wind in my face. My body froze, and I held onto the board as hard as I could, concentrating on not falling off. I didn't want to be rolled around by a wave that size. I raced forward through the water and forgot all about standing up because of the frightening speed I had gained. When I finally put one knee up on the board, it was too late and it had lost its power. The intense adrenaline rush made me forget everything about being tired, cold, and having sore shoulders, and I ended up spending at least an hour more catching more and more waves. It was time to make a decision. I had to find an internet place and get myself some tickets for my next destination. I was in the middle of nowhere in Taiwan, and I had only 2.5 weeks to work my way to New York where I would meet my girlfriend. I liked the spontaneous planning, but not the rush. Originally, I hadn't planned on going to Taiwan for more than a day or so I was already pushing my schedule quite a bit, having been there for 4 days. We found a cafe downtown with a fast internet connection. I had postponed the decision of going to Japan or not for too long. The situation there had been too much for me to think about, but unless I went to Hong Kong, Shanghai, or Korea first, Tokyo seemed up next. I had to make a choice. There was a lot of information online about the situation in Japan, and it was difficult to figure out what to believe and what not to. Someone had set up live webcams filming Geiger counters around the country. As far as I could see, the radiation was twice the normal level, but still way below dangerous. It still scared me though. What if the Japanese government was hiding something and I risked my health? I was definitely planning to have kids one day. I could jeopardize my own health, but what about my future kids? I'd gotten several emails from Japan from people writing about my concerns on the blog. The only real danger seemed to be the big earthquakes. Apart from the aspect of people losing their lives and homes, I've always been fascinated by natural disasters. Hurricanes, earthquakes, floodings, all had me glued to the television screen. In a time where mankind controls so many aspects of nature and the earth, it is fascinating to see and feel that we are still completely helpless and incredibly tiny when nature decides to show its real powers. Experiencing an earthquake in Japan, as stupid as it may sound, was a very intriguing thought to me. I wanted to feel nature in its rawest form. A few years earlier, we had one in Denmark. It was the only one in 100 years or so and really small, although big enough to be felt. It was in the morning and it was the only time ever that I was sad that my jiu-jitsu life allowed me to always sleep late. We discussed it back and forth. I decided that I had to do it. I was on the adventure of my life and I had to take risks like that. I couldn't allow myself to play it safe. Many people at home had been worried whether I decided to go to Japan or not. I could understand that sitting at home and watching the news, it looked like the obvious choice to skip a dangerous place like that. It was hard for me to explain to anyone why going there was important to me. I had promised to push myself to the limit on the trip, to go the furthest I could and never turn down any opportunities for special experiences. It was a very special time in Japan's history, and all worries about my safety aside, everything inside me urged me to go there. I booked a one-way ticket, leaving Taiwan 2 days later. Val walked into the cafe. He was already wearing his gi pants, ready to train. My knee hurt and I was tired from surfing all morning, but I definitely wanted to roll. After having such a great training the day before, I was psyched to get back on the mats. Daniel had given me a good challenge, so I wanted to spend some more training time with him. It looked funny when Val raced through the dark streets on his little scooter in front of us. He was wearing a winter jacket and held a big fan in his hand that was rotating in the wind. The gym was basically a small garage on a street corner in the dirty part of a dirty town. The walls were made of metal. A few puzzle mats were laid out in the corner and a thick blanket was placed under a heavy bag. On the walls hung a handful of tie pads and mitts, and from the ceiling, a homemade pull-up bar made from rope and an old tire. The place was a mess, but had a very authentic look to it, and could easily be the gym of any bad guy in a Van Damme movie. It took me a while to warm up. My body was really tired from sitting in a car for so many hours, then training and surfing. Reggae music played from a small stereo standing on the table, and we were 5 guys taking turns to roll on the small matted area. Everyone wanted to go around with me, and when I was warmed up, I got into a good rhythm and felt great. An American guy, probably around his late 40s or early 50s, introduced himself as Peter. He was in good shape for his age, had a gentleman's mustache and a great southern accent. He was a former wrestler that had been living in Taiwan for 12 years running a pizza shop. He hadn't trained for ages but heard I was in town and wanted to come and check it out. We clapped hands and I sat down in my car. He grabbed my wrist and ankle and I immediately noticed that he had quite unusual grip strength. I let him pass my guard to see what his game was like. He obviously didn't really know what to do with me, but just sat on his knees next to me. He grabbed both my wrists and pinned them to my chest. I was still relaxed and thought I would pull guard in a second and then look for a light sweep to get back on top. That's when I realized that I couldn't move. His grip was so strong, and even with his arms straight, sitting on his knees and pinning my arms to my chest, I couldn't get up. It was crazy. Val coached Peter from the sideline. "Use your wrestling," he shouted. It was like a light bulb went on in his head, and he was taken back to his young days. He grabbed me in a strange headlock pin and grapevined my legs in a sort of a half guard, compressing my lungs to the size of a tennis ball and making it impossible for me to move even an inch. I was being totally dominated by an old wrestler that had shown up out of the blue in the middle of nowhere in Taiwan. With much effort, I finally managed to escape and catch him in a guillotine. He hadn't wrestled for 20 years and was interested in learning about jiu-jitsu. I spent a little time explaining to him about passing the guard using hip pressure. He would have to get my legs in position and obtain the right angle. "And then you just do a sprawl on my hips," I said. He reacted like a robot. As soon as he heard the word sprawl, in the blink of an eye, his legs disappeared behind him and his hips slammed into the floor. As if the long-forgotten movements of wrestling were programmed into his mind and the right keyword would make them wake up 20 years later. I hope anyone won't accidentally one day yell sprawl when he's standing in the line in the supermarket or something. When evening came, I couldn't sleep. One of the purple belts I had trained with for many years at home had written on his Facebook status that he decided to stop training. Losing someone from my team who I had been through so much training with was a big thing, and it bothered me a lot. The thoughts raced through my head. Was this one of the consequences of me leaving the gym for so long? Before I left, I had been starting to get really nervous about whether everything I had built up would be gone when I got home, wondering if people would go to other gyms or the kids' team would dissolve. Had I been too selfish in leaving everything and everyone behind like that? I had to talk with him when I got home. I knew there could be lots of reasons for him to quit, but I couldn't stop feeling that it was somehow my fault. It was time to hit the road and get back to Taipei. We packed the car and entered the destination on the GPS. After 6 hours of zigzagging through mountain roads, the light from the Taipei 101 tower appeared in the horizon and we had successfully driven all the way around the country. It wasn't really our initial plan, and it ended up being the biggest detour anyone in the history of the world had ever taken just to drop off a microwave oven. I was leaving Taiwan, and the experiences there had really planted some thoughts in my head. Originally, I had planned to spend just one day in Taipei in case I could get a cheap ticket with a stop over there before going to Japan. I didn't, however, know anything about the place and therefore assumed that there was nothing for me to find there. Even one day there seemed like it would take a lot of valuable time out of my tight schedule, so the thought didn't really appeal to me that much. I ended up spending 5 days in Taiwan, and I don't regret it for a second. If I knew on beforehand what experiences were waiting for me there, I would have been crazy to, even for a second, consider not going. I had amazing memories from other places on the trip, but the difference is that these destinations and connections were all planned out well ahead of time from home. Taiwan was a decision I took only a few days before going there. I didn't know Daniel before I set foot in the country, but I ended up spending my entire stay with him. I realized that adventure is everywhere and became confident that I could buy a plane ticket to any place in the world, no matter how foreign, strange, or dangerous it might seem from a distance, and it would contain friends and experiences that I would treasure for life. My mindset definitely took a turn to, if possible, an even more adventurous state, and I intended to try out my theory.